All right. That's a little cynical, but yeah. So if you have a chance, we won't do it this afternoon, but if you have a chance, there's a series of videos. Actually, you can just Google Church Hunters, and there's a series of videos that a guy has done based on House Hunters, but helping people find the right church. But I love that video for a number of reasons, but one of the things that I find instructive and helpful about it is, let me go back to the beginning. What I find somewhat helpful and instructive about it, and I like to show it with students, is so the word liturgy is a word that means the work of the people. And we have had, most of us in this room have come from a somewhat non-liturgical movement. We oftentimes, or church historically, would call our forms of worship free forms of worship, free or low liturgy. And but I show that video to students who don't think they're liturgical to say, you may not think you're liturgical, but there is actually a rhythm to worship that you just recognized and laughed through. In fact, I was invited to speak at a church not long ago. I won't tell you which one, but I was invited to speak at a church, and I got tickled at the ways in which the church service followed that video to a T. Like, I mean, it was, I know, to the point of, I was texting my wife during church, which is not a good thing to do, but I was texting her. I said, you won't believe how much this church was like the video. And then, rather than a pulpit, they brought me out a table and a chair, just like the guy to sit down. They had a transitional video while I was coming. You know, I was just, anyway, but the students were laughing. You know, he's laughing. I say, "What you laugh? You don't think you're liturgical, but you recognize that service. You recognize that. So you are liturgical. There is a work of the people that you are doing, and the whole idea of a liturgy is that it's forming us some way. And so, what I want them to kind of wrestle with is this question: not do you recognize yourself there, or do you like that kind of church? But how are we being formed through the kinds of worship that we do? And so what I want to mainly talk about with you this hour, and I'll talk for a little bit and invite, hopefully not talk so long that I don't leave time for you to ask questions and for us to have a conversation together about, I think this is a really important conversation. But I want you to hear this right off the bat. This is not a question about style preference. It's not a question about one generation likes this kind of thing, another generation likes this kind of thing. It's not even a conversation about, man, I really miss when we dress nice to come to worship. I joke with my children, I turned 50 a year ago, I'm 51, and I joke every year I feel more and more like the two old Muppets that sit in the top of the, you know, I used to be the guy who would say, why are these old people so cranky all the time? And now I'm one of them, right? Yeah. Now I'm one of them. But this isn't an attempt to just be kind of a grouchy Muppet in the theater, but it is an attempt to say this. Worship is formative. The kinds of worship that we've done in previous generations was formative. The kinds of worship we're doing now is formative. And my primary question is to ask this: what kind of people are we forming through the worship that we are doing? And how do we think seriously about the kinds of people we want to have formed? And therefore, how should we worship? And how should worship form us? Okay? Does that make sense? So I mentioned, and I'm sorry, you know, I know this is a massive screen for those of you in the back, but I mentioned Alistair MacIntyre, a favorite philosopher ethicist of mine. But one of the things I love, so when I was working on my degree in ethics, most of the time when I would get to teach ethics classes, students would be kind of excited to take an ethics class because they thought they were coming to a class where we would spend the 16 weeks just talking about different issues, right? So a lot of times you go to ethics class and say, okay, this week we're going to talk about abortion. And so we just spend two or three class sessions kind of mapping out different views of abortion, then arguing with each other, and then going home, right? And then next week we're going to talk about capital punishment. And next week we're going to talk about immigration. So we deal with all these issues. I think that's important. But the kind of ethics that made me most interested was not sort of ethics that went from issue to issue to issue, but ethics that thought about what kind of character should we have. Because especially in the complicated world, for example, raising children, I'm not sure that I'll have the ability, even as a parent, to walk through every issue my child will face across their life and help them think through what those issues will be. So my goal, and Devin, my goal has been to raise children who are really good people and who have a kind of character that then when they encounter tough issues, that they'll almost instinctively do the right thing because they've been formed to be a certain kind of people. And so that's what McIntyre is most interested in. So one of the things that drew me to McIntyre was his critique of a culture is not so much the issues that a culture faces as much as what are the kinds of people that that culture produces. So when we look at America, for example, and judge us as a culture, we shouldn't judge us necessarily on how much freedom we give to people, but what kind of people are formed by the freedom that we give to them. Does that make sense? That was really good, by the way. And that traditions, then, for him, are socially embodied, historically extended arguments for truth. I don't have time to get into the complicatedness of that. But one of the ways that this idea shaped me is to say, in this exile conversation, the church is a unique people that embodies socially and historically extends a certain way of understanding in the world and forms that. And so I mentioned earlier, you know, I can only answer the question, what am I to do if I can figure out what story am I a part of? So that McIntyre would say, we look something like this. Here is the church. We have a vision of where we're moving. If you were here at the 11 o'clock session, I talked about N.T. Wright has a statement he calls eschatological authenticity, that we have a vision of what we should be, of the new creation, and we're moving towards that. And we're embodying that in our life together as a church. But for McIntyre, as we do that, there are two things that form that. And I mentioned them in the first session today. Stories and practices. So we have to have a certain kind of story that tells us how we're moving, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. That's true not just of church, that's true of everything. So let me use America as an example. As soon as you go to school when you're a child in America, we start telling you stories, okay? And we call them history or social studies, but they're really just stories. And we're telling you stories of people who embodied the vision of what we think America should be well. So we tell you about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, all the faces on Mount Rushmore. We even tell you some stories of people who did it badly, so don't be like Benedict Arnold, boo, hiss. You know, we'll tell some bad stories, so you don't be like those people, but you be like these others. So we tell you stories, but we also immerse you in practices. So the first day of kindergarten, we put you at round tables. First of all, in kindergarten, you get put at round tables. And we give you a picture of a duck or something to color. But then we only put 8 crayons in the middle of the table. Because one of the first things we have to teach you is to do what?
Share.
You got to share. And the second thing we teach you is the teacher has the floor. And if you want the floor, what do you need to do? Raise your hand. You learned really well. You raise your hand. Because here's the thing. Democracies don't work if we all just yell all the time at each other and don't listen. And so we want every voice to be heard. But there's practices we have to do in order to be heard. We have recess not just to wear you out and get a little of your kindergarten energy out, but we also, there's teamwork that we learn on the playground, and there's kinds of rules that all of that teaches us. So all of that embodies that life. We learn it in narratives and practices, and as we're doing those things, then McIntyre would say certain virtues that we need to have in order to get there happen. So all of that to say, this is how I think about ministry. The primary thing, tomorrow morning, I'm excited. If Southwest gets me home tonight, I'll get up in the morning and get to tell the story again. I'm going to get to tell it out of 2 Peter chapter 3 tomorrow, or 1 Peter chapter 3 tomorrow. I'm excited to kind of proclaim the story. But I get, you know, you'd think after this many years of the church, we'd get a new book at some point. But no, we're just going to keep working at it. You know, we'll use these 66 and we'll tell these stories over and over again. We're going to form people into these inspired stories. But we're also going to do certain practices that form us to be that people. And so if you were listening this morning when I told the parable of the ducks, that's mainly what I want us to think about here. We can tell the story, but everybody will quack their amens. But what are the practices that are forming us and forming for us virtues of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control, all those virtues that are consistent with the fruit of the Spirit or consistent with the holy life? How are those being formed? So with regards to this story, I told a little bit about this in the morning, but you know, somebody like N.T. Wright has really been messing me up in some good ways in terms of when we tell the story, we tell the story as the new creation breaking in. We're not a people, so this is important for me. We're not just telling people endure exile, but we are really, as we feel the sense of exile, we're called to be a people who embody a way of life that the world doesn't understand in its own terms. I'll say this is part of the reason why I think if we preach the story well, we tend to feel odd in the world. So I'll pick on politics because I'm going to get in a plane on a plane in just a few minutes. But I think one of the challenges for us, having just come through a political season, is there are parts of the Christian story that seem to fit well with politics on the right, but not fully. And I would say there's a lot of the Christian story that seems to fit with what we would call politics of the left today, but not fully. Mm-hmm. And so one of the oddnesses is that there are times where you feel co-opted by one side or the other, you know, and the whole point is that the church should embody something the right or the left they don't understand on their own terms. Because the church is not conservative or liberal, right or left. The church is the embodiment of a kingdom the world doesn't understand. And so people often say, why don't you preach more about politics? And what they mean by that is, why don't I tell you who to vote for? And I don't do that because I like my job. But I say to them, I preach on politics every week. You're just not paying attention.
There you go. Uh-huh.
Because I'm calling you to be something that's not defined by right or left, that moves past that to be a people who embody it. So that's our story. But how do we practice that? And I would say orthodoxy, so we use a word like orthodox a lot. Is this orthodox? You know, one of the things that happens when you go into exile too is you worry, are we orthodox? Are we part of this living tradition? Or have we strayed from something? So we use the word orthodox a lot. And we usually mean it to say, are we confessing the right things or mainly thinking the right things, which is important. And we need to confess the right things and think the right things. And we'll figure all that out next month at General Assembly and we'll get it finally right. But no, I'm just kidding. That's an ongoing conversation. But thinking the right things isn't necessarily all that orthodoxy is about. In fact, to quote James, even the demons kind of know the right things, but it doesn't matter. You can confess a lot of things. You can know a lot of things without truly being orthodox. The word orthodox actually means right worship. So then I would kind of argue the problem in the scripture is not so much the Israelites started thinking things they shouldn't think. The problem was they started worshiping gods that weren't Yahweh. That it's primarily about right worship. How do we worship God rightly? And so this chart is basically, as we worship God rightly, then everything else seems to fall into place. So we think about the garden narrative. As Adam and Eve live in right harmony with God, they live in harmony with each other, with the creation, with the self. But as soon as that relationship with God is broken, they no longer worship God rightly, which is the temptation of the serpent. You can be your own God. Move to forms of idolatry, even if it's self-idolatry. Once we don't worship God rightly, then that relationship is broken, and now all of a sudden we blame and shame each other. One of my favorite moments in the garden story is when God finds Adam and says, "What have you done?" And Adam gets a double blame in. Don't look at me. This woman, you created. Like, there's three of us in the garden, and you are the two responsible, not me. So we get to blame and shame. The relationship with creation is broken. They're naked and ashamed. So all of that is broken. So right worship is central to our living rightly in the world. I'm going to skip that one. But the person who has helped me a lot is a really dear friend of mine who we got to know each other. We spent a summer together in Grand Rapids several years ago and became really close friends. We both have four children. They're the same age, so our families hung out. But he's a lot smarter than me and a really gifted guy. Teaches philosophy at Calvin College, but a guy named James K.A. Smith is the name he writes under. His friends call him Jamie. But Jamie has written a number of really good books. But if you're a reader and you're interested in this kind of stuff, my favorite book of Jamie's is a book called Desiring the Kingdom. There's a book that's more recent and a little bit more accessible for people, but it's a book called You Are What You Love. But Jamie, where Jamie has really helped me is to think about this word liturgy. So that liturgies, Jamie says, are acts, practices of ultimate concern. They're things that shape us to view something as most important. And that liturgies aim our love, and what liturgies are trying to do is primarily get us to love something. And you will become what you love.
Right.
So for Jamie, you can't help but love something. We are lovers by nature, and we're worshipers by nature. In fact, Jamie will say he doesn't like the term homo sapien, which means humankind the thinker. He prefers homo liturgicus, humankind the worshiper. And this is very Augustinian for those of you who are into Augustine or writing dissertations on Augustine. You are what you love. For Augustine, he is convinced his problem, the biggest problem in his life, is he's learned to love the wrong things. And as Augustine will say, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. And if he can get his loves right, what happens is what you love will draw you in. It doesn't act like a goal you move towards. It acts like a vacuum that sucks you towards it, that draws you towards what you will love. But here's where Jamie has helped me. We're learning to love things all the time, but we're primarily learning to love things through our bodies. Through our bodies. You're being taught to love things, and almost the time you don't even know that you're being taught to love it. So that practices matter. So I'll pick on the Super Bowl here for a minute. That we learn to worship from the ground up. We learn to love things, Jamie will say, from the ground up. We are taught it through practices with our bodies, through various cultural liturgies. So Jamie will say, for example, when you go to the arena, you're being taught to love something. And football is kind of an interesting example. A lot of our love for nation, for example, a lot of our patriotism, a lot of our nationalism comes to us, and there's a kind of interesting history behind it, but comes to us through our athletic practices. Some of you are interested. There are scholars who write about the sort of sociology of our different games. If you're a basketball fan, you know it's a very urban sport. It's a small, confined space. It's just you and three or four of your gang members, right? And you got to kind of survive in this very tight world. And there are moments of kind of individual stardom, but it's really a lot about teamwork. There's a lot of writing about baseball as an immigrant sport. And it's very popular with immigrants. But it's kind of you against the world, right? One guy against nine. And if you only have about a 25-30% chance of making it home, right? So that you gotta kind of go from safe place to safe place to safe place until you finally find your way home. Anyway, kind of interesting. But football is military, right? Football, you have a field general who throws bombs down the field, and it's about taking territory, offensive lines, defensive lines. So it shouldn't surprise us that the Super Bowl, in our imaginations, it's gotten mixed up then with a lot of militarism. So there's a lot of celebration of the military connected to football. There's a, Jamie would say there's a flag the size of the football field, people running underneath it so that it waves. And just when we get to the high note of the anthem, the land of the free, jets go flying over so that we not only hear it, but we feel, the power of the story. So that it's inscribing. So Jamie wants to say, don't act like you're not worshiping. And I would say, if you don't think it's an act of worship, try being a quarterback who decides to not stand for the anthem and see how that goes. You don't think it's culturally religious. So that we're learning to love certain things. And so what happens then when we gather for worship is much of what happens for us is we're learning what Jamie will call counter-liturgies. So we've been shaped over and over all week long to learn to love certain things. And part of what the church does, and I would, as a professor, I would say much of what education should do too, is try to teach us counter-liturgies, counter-formation. So hang with me. So here's an example. If you read Desiring the Kingdom, Jamie starts the Desiring the Kingdom with he says, imagine that there are Martian anthropologists, anthropologists who come from Mars to study humankind. And they want to know, these people seem like religious people. We should figure out what they love most. And so they see all these people headed to this place that looks like it must be a place of worship. So there are a lot of people going there. And it's sort of shaped like worship. There's no windows. I mean, when you walk in, there's no clocks on the wall, so you lose all sense of time. The only windows are in the ceiling, so that your gaze is upward. And it's kind of a fascinating place of worship because, like a great cathedral, the colors change with the liturgical seasons of the year. But Jamie will say, as you enter in, there are some people who seem right at home here. They must worship a lot. But there's some newbies who have to come and kind of consult the guide to get through this great cathedral. He says, as you're going through, there are all these little chapels. And you go to chapel after chapel, but unlike the great ancient cathedrals that just have flat, one-dimensional icons, these have chapels with three-dimensional icons, with visions of the good life. And you think, oh, finally one draws your attention. You think, oh, yes, that speaks to me. So you enter into the chapel, and Jamie says there's an acolyte who greets you. and who offers to lead you on your quest as you go through the racks looking for what you're seeking. And once you find what you're seeking for, you go to the altar and the priest meets you there, and there's an exchange. It's like Sunday morning offering, right? You give and they you give and receive. So even, and the priest wraps it in the colors of the season and then offers you a benediction. You know, as you go, come back again. You know, there's a benediction that you're left with. But you realize that you're at the mall. I mean, you're about halfway through and you realize, I think we're at the mall. And then he lets you know, yes, this is the liturgy of the mall. And there's really insightful stuff there about how is the mall shaping us? How are we being shaped at the game? How are we being shaped as we watch television? How are we being shaped? So everything becomes a kind of liturgy. Everything becomes a heart habit, something that's forming our vision of the good life. How did we come, for example, to think all of us, and you are all very fashionably dressed today, but how did we come to think that was fashionable? Or how did we come to think the things that we just ate for lunch are delicious? Right? That's not all genetics. That's cultural formation and coming to see certain body types, certain things as beautiful. All of that is shaped in us. That desire is shaped in us through various cultural liturgies. And what's really kind of insane, if you will, about our culture is the way in which, in particular, consumerism has taken on very religious aspects. So if we went back 3 or 4 decades, most advertising was used words, whiter, brighter, faster, cleaner. But then advertisers realized, at some point all detergents kind of get everything clean. And so you can't just say, well, this is whiter or brighter, and they all kind of work. So now what you have to do is you have to connect some sense of meaning to the product. So now it's not just that Tide gets your clothes cleaner, but you are a Tide user. There has to be some meaning to Tide. So, the problem today, like buying a car, most cars, it used to be, you don't want to buy an Edsel. Yeah. That's a lemon. Most cars today will get you 150,000 miles, pretty good. Maybe a couple of exceptions, but most cars are really good. So what do we have to do now? Now we have car ads where, like, you touch the car and you have this vision of your life in the car. Mm-hmm. Well, there's certain people who drive those cars, and somehow if I drive those cars, maybe then I'm somehow associated with those people. That's why there are hood ornaments on the front of cars. Not so we can recognize our car in the parking lot. We have the little bleeper who will help us find that. But so when we're driving down the road, people know we drive Jaguars, or we drive, they'll know who we are. There's a sense of identity, a sense of meaning attached to certain things. So quickly, I'll just pick on one product. I do this with students, but I love to pick on Abercrombie and Fitch for a lot of reasons. But most of you aren't familiar with them because none of us are skinny enough to shop there. But this is the closest thing to an appropriate ad I could show today from Abercrombie and Fitch. But usually they're very sexualized. And I often joke, I say to them, this is an Abercrombie and Fitch ad, and I'm glad that I know what they sell there, because I'm not sure. There's 2 pieces of clothing that appear in this ad. It's a clothing store, by the way. There's 2 pieces of clothing, and I'm not sure you actually can buy them there. I don't know that they sell swimsuits there, and I don't know if that t-shirt is not just a Hanes t-shirt. So I'll ask things, what is Abercrombie and Fitch actually selling? They're selling an image that says, and I don't have the abs to shop there, but they're selling an image of youthfulness, sexuality. And so the idea is, I don't know what they sell there, but I'll have what they're having. That's what I need, that's what I want. Most of our liturgies kind of function that way. And this is the chart that Jamie gives that says, here's our vision of the good life, and our loves move there. But here's the key for us this afternoon. Our heart is formed by these practices, by these liturgies. We're constantly being formed. And so we need to do 2 things. We need to do an assessment of the kinds of liturgies that are shaping us. And so for Jamie, it's very important, for example, that we know, it's not that we should avoid the mall, but we should recognize that the mall is trying to get us to love certain things. Because Jamie's kids are my age, I've said to him one time, I said, Jamie, your kids have to go to the mall. I mean, my kids go. I said, what do you do when they ask you for the keys to go to the mall? He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, they do that. But they'll say to me, hey, Dad, can we borrow the keys? We're going to the temple of consumption. And he looked at me, he said, but at least they know what it's trying to do to them. Yeah. And so I'm not one who says that we should, decide to sit through the anthem. But I do think as Christians, we should know what the anthem's trying to do to us. and be aware of the ways in which there are loves being formed in us, and not all of those are consistent with the loves of the gospel. Some may be, but most are not. And those loves, those idols compete with each other. And so here's the question then that I want us to ask in worship, and I'll come back to it, but let me go ahead and land, and then you can take a nap, and we'll come back. But the question that shapes me most in thinking about worship tomorrow morning and what we're doing as a church, and I've tried to encourage those who helped me in the planning of worship, when we gather together, to not ask the question, will everybody like it? I'd like to get us past that question. And so we'll often start with this question: how will God be glorified? Will God be pleased with what we do next week? Will God be honored in our worship? But then I also want to ask this question: if people attend my church and worship and are part of that local body of Christ for 10 years, what kind of people will we have formed them to become at the end of 10 years? I will often ask students to go visit high churches or various kinds of worship services, but I say, I want you to write a paper on it. But if you write a paper that asks and answers this question, did I like it, I will give you an F, because I don't care. I really don't care how you feel about it. I want you to ask this question: what kind of Christian would I be if I attended this church for a decade? What was the worship trying to do to me and to my heart today? See, that's a question that we are so shaped by consumerism, that's not a question we ask very often. So back to education for a minute. I think education should be thermostatic. It should be changing. So I say to students, I promise you at the university, at least as long as I have a say, we will never teach a class on how to tweet well. Although we have some leaders who could have used that class. But we don't. We will not offer a class on how to tweet well. Because this generation does not need one more opportunity to communicate in 140 characters or less. They do not. What they need is somebody who says, you're going to have to write a 15 to 20 page paper.
Yes.
Because most issues are too complex to be dealt with in 140 characters. So what you need is somebody who is going to force you to think about various voices and how complicated this issue is, and to articulate that, not easily, but in complex ways. You don't need a course on how to surf the internet and how to find fake news on the internet. You're good at that. What you need is somebody who helps you how to really research things. Yeah. So I'll say, at the end of the semester, as you fill out your class evaluation, please do not, I mean, I hope you liked it, and I hope you liked me, and I hope you want to take another class with me. That's all great. But please, it doesn't helpful for me when you fill out the evaluation to ask, did I like this class? What I'd like you to do is you fill out your evaluation is ask this question: did this class mess me up in good ways? Did this class force me to do some things I would not have done if I hadn't paid the money and gone through this class? Because that's what formation should do. And that's a very hard question for us to ask. And so in some ways, what I've been learning is, and what Jamie too has been teaching me, is there are some practices that we as the church have lost that we probably need to recover and think through the wisdom of the history of the church and the ways in which, not because people will be necessarily attracted to those practices, but because those practices will form us to be the people that we're called to be. So I'll just give you some quick examples, and then we can talk. So I'm one of those proponents of thinking through keeping liturgical time. So I love that churches I've been a part of now are kind of in the rhythms of Advent and Epiphany and Lent, and we're in Easter season, heading to Pentecost and then into Common Time. There's something about the keeping of time that does something to our bodies and to our imaginations that I think is important. I say to students, I know you're excited to graduate from college, but let me tell you something. When you graduate, your body's going to freak out on you. Because for 22, 23 years, we've had you on an academic calendar. And so every August, you think it's time to go to Staples and buy new notebooks and sharpen pencils. But next year, you're going to have a job. And August is just like March, and January is just like June. You get 2 weeks vacation, and everything else is the same. Congratulations, right? And it's going to be until you have children, and you got to get back on it. There is, you know, your body won't know what to do. You've been on a rhythm. I think there's something profound that is shaped in us when we get together and we not only think about the coming of Christ into the world, but we think about how deeply the world needs him to come again. But then we think about the light has come among us and invites us to be reflections of that light through Epiphany. And then we journey beneath the shadow of the cross and we think deeply about our sin and our brokenness and how that is met and confronted and entered into by Christ. But then we celebrate that sin doesn't get the last word, grace does. Life, death doesn't get the last word, life does, right? That we enter into Easter season where now we think about what does it mean to be people who reflect eschatological authenticity, who live as people of the resurrection, and now we enter into this great expanse of time that the church just calls common time, the regular old time. How do we live that out? And there's something about that rhythm that's important. I'm really particular about this. I have become very adamant about being called to worship. The sense that God has invited us. We didn't just come because this is our regular habit, but somehow we heard the voice of God inviting us to come and be drawn near to Him, and we have responded to that call. And there's something even scandalous about it, that we're a people, and I used to think about the call to worship a lot when in Pasadena, I'd leave the house about 6:30, and it was usually right around the same time my neighbor was in his bathrobe picking up his newspaper, his LA Times. From his driveway. And we'd kind of wave at each other and he'd say, "Hey, have a nice day at church." And I'd say, "Yeah, have a nice day reading the paper, you know, and watching football or whatever this is going to be today." There's a kind of a scandal that not everybody heard the call. But there are these people who have responded to the call of God, and we're really diverse people who may not have been connected for any other reason except that we're the people who responded to God's call to come and meet uniquely with Him. Most people want to talk about praise and worship, and there's a lot to talk about there, way more than we can handle today. I just would say I want to constantly think about, the things that we sing will become our heart theology. When I became a pastor, I didn't realize how many people I'd be with when they were dying. And when I walk into a hospital room and somebody knows they're getting towards the end, I joke that I've been offended that I've never walked into a hospital room and somebody said, "Oh, Pastor, we're so glad you're here. Our time is short, and we just wondered if we could get one more sermon from you. We were just hoping if you could just break open the Word, give us one more of those great sermons." No one ever asked for that. They kind of know I sing. So I walk into a hospital room, and what do people say? "Oh, so glad you're here. We were just wanting somebody to lead us and it is well with my soul." Mm-hmm. And we just wanted to sing "How Great Thou Art." We just wanted to sing "How Great Is Our God." We just wanted to sing "Amazing Grace." There's something about what we sing that becomes our bone theology. And so I like a lot of the new stuff we sing. I like that there are a lot of artists today who are recovering some of the ancient songs of the church and bringing them into ways that sort of meet with contemporary ears. I love that my children know the words to "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace." Great song. I'm glad we haven't lost it. I'm glad that there are ways in which that rich heart theology. There are some songs I don't like very well. And there's a few that I've changed the words to and still change the words to. Because the more we sing it, the more that theology gets into our bones. And I want us to think about that. I want us to think about the ways in which the worship that we're doing reflects an awful lot of our culture. So in showing the video, the one thing that I would say there is that I'm picky about language. And so with my staff, I say, if you want to get in trouble with me, do this. Call the congregation an audience. You'll get in trouble with me. They're not an audience. God is the audience today. They're the congregation. This is a sanctuary, a place set apart for worship. This is not an auditorium. It looks like an auditorium because that's how we build most of our sanctuaries these days. So people feel like they're in a theater because they have theater seats and the lights go down just and the show's about to begin. So it's not their fault. But it's not an auditorium, it's a sanctuary. And this is not the stage. This is a platform. The stage is a place actors act. The platform is a place where people lead. One of the things that concerns me about contemporary worship, so I'll sound like the old Muppet here, is just the ways in which an awful lot of it reflects. I went to go see U2 last week in the arena in Seattle. And it was really fun to go see Mumford & Sons and U2. But it was a concert. I knew I was at a concert. Most weeks when I go to church, I think I like what U2 did, but most Sunday mornings, what we do on Sunday morning is more shaped by what U2 did in the arena that night than it is by the idea that there are people who are leading a congregation in worship. Does that
Is that fair?
Yeah, all right, good. So I mean, there's just lots to think about there in worship and what it means to lead people, what it means to make sure generations are worshiping together, how we do that. Congregational prayer, I think there's so much theology in what it means to lead people in prayer. Lots that we could say there, but preaching as a way to get people to see the world differently. A lot of our preaching has become helpful. I joke that I'm really unhelpful. We feel like people have problems, and they do. And so we feel like most of our preaching needs to address their problems. And so we end up preaching a lot of sermons about, and we want everybody to get along with their spouse and their kids. So I'm going to do a series on getting along in your relationships of your life. And it just happens every sermon has 5 points, and they all start with the letter B or whatever. That we're trying to be helpful. And I think there are really important places for the church to be helpful. But I think when that becomes the dominant practice in preaching, we're making the gospel a condiment. We're making the gospel something that helps people in what they're going to do anyway. I think the majority of preaching should be the invitation to see the world through the eyes of the gospel.
There you go.
And that needs to be the most common practice that we participate in so that people soak in the language of the scripture until they see their lives through those glasses. I can't tell you how good that point was. Baptism, you know, I love that we're recovering that sense of what it means to be a people who you're joined because we threw you in the water and we held you under for a little while. And we, you know, that Adam's a very good swimmer. So that old Adam's, so he puts you in there and you come participating in the resurrection of Christ. And that is your connection to the body of Christ. And what it means for us to be a baptismal people is incredibly profound. When I was a college pastor, I really was letting this group of college students have it on what it meant to be the body of Christ. And we're baptized together. So this was when I was on staff at Pasadena First. We were baptizing in chronological order, so the kids went first, then the teens, then the college students. And so we're just ready to step in the baptismal, and the first girl stops me. She goes, "Wait, I don't know if I can do this." And I thought she was nervous because we were making them testify. And I said, "Oh, Lisa, you'll be fine. Just tell them what Jesus has done in your life. They'll love you." And she goes, "Oh, no, I don't care about that." She said, "After this is over, everything will be different." She goes, "You and I will be brother and sister." And I'm not sure I'm ready for that. I said, "Move aside." You know, but she, you know, finally at the last one, she gave me the thumbs up. But it's fascinating. That was 20 years ago. And she and I communicate all the time. And she teases me about, she is not letting me out of my baptismal obligation to her. You know, that we are brother and sister. And what it means to recover that idea of connection. I love that churches are rediscovering what it means to gather around the table on a regular basis. As Will Willimon says, in that meal, the famous line that you are what you eat, nowhere is that more true than in the Eucharist. And there's something profound about again, what are we learning through our bodies? That the gospel isn't just something we came to look at today and say, "Wow, that's really great that Jesus did that. Everybody glad Jesus did this? Jesus is my favorite on three. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, Jesus is my favorite." You know, like, we don't come just to say that's what you, but we gather around the table then to say, this is what Jesus did, but he has invited us to participate in it. And so now we're taking that into us. And there's a mystery of grace where we're becoming the body of Christ together. And now, man, now we're brother and sister. We're ear and eye, hand and foot, connected to each other, now sent into the world to be the body of Christ. There's something that's mysterious about that.
That's awesome.
And I could be wrong about this, but I'm convinced we have debates sometimes about how much should people know or how much should they be committed before they come to the table. I tend to lean towards having a pretty open table. So I'll give you one quick story. My wife and I have 4 kids, and when they were real little, we were having an Ash Wednesday service, and my wife came down to the table. She brought all 4 little ones, just like little ducklings all in a row, came and got the Eucharistic elements. And Debbie led them up to the cross on the platform. And like many people, they were gathered on the platform. But they were sitting there. And I watched her distribute the elements to them and pray together and all that kind of stuff. And I had a gentleman come up afterwards who was not real happy with me and said, "Hey, I watched your family tonight, and I'm kind of bothered." I mean, he said, I don't know. I was watching your children eat it, and like one of your sons licked the cup, you know, kind of did that thing with it. He said, I don't know if they should do that. I don't know how much they understand about that. And it was one of those moments where God gives you the right thing to say at the right time. And I said, "I don't know how much you understand about
that." Amen. Come on, man.
So now, and between you and me, I have a PhD in this stuff, and I don't know how much I understand. Like, there's, I keep coming to this table, and there's more mystery there.
Yes, yes.
And I'm one who would say, I would rather my children lick the cup a little bit. I mean, that they would, they would grow, if you understand what I'm saying about liturgy,
yes, sir.
That they would come to understand about Christ because they participated in practices that now they can't get out of.
Yeah.
It's formed their loves. It's formed their heart. It's formed them in those kinds of ways. And so I'm thankful for that. And the one that I love, I joke with the board, you know, someday when the Lord takes me somewhere else, I hope that the first question you ask, you know, that I've messed you up so bad that the first two questions you ask a candidate for pastor is, you do Lent, right? You know, you do the church season. And secondly, you pray benedictions. You pray benedictions, right? And what it means to get to bless the congregation as we are, my friend Brent Peterson says, worship is like the inhaling and exhaling of God. That the call to worship is God breathing in and drawing his people close to his heart, but then he exhales and sends his body back into the world. And there is a rhythm of gathering and in worship, both receiving and giving. So I should have included the offering up there. What kind of pastor am I? Giving and receiving and worship and giving, but then of being sent back into the world as the body and being blessed and sent in that kind of way. And so the rhythm of worship, gathering, giving, receiving, and sending. And so, you know, for me, the worship questions have become, is God glorified in this? Are we being formed as a people? And that's my question. Again, please hear me say this. This is not a style thing, because I think formation can happen in a lot of different styles. So this isn't a style organ versus guitar or drums versus whatever kind of question. This is a question of what kind of formation happens. Because in the same way that I want to say, I think a lot of our worship just takes consumers and doesn't shape them out of their consumption, just turns Jesus into one more thing to consume. But I don't think that's just true of young generations. I think that's true of older generations too, that all of us come to church with this primary question in mind, did I like this? And that's not the question. The question is, was God glorified, and how was I formed today? How did the work that we did together change me? And are we being counterformed as a people who are reflections of God's character? I think there's a lot that's formed in us in the culture that needs to be counterformed. And so we have to think a lot about how does our worship counterform us? And it should be uncomfortable then. Because we feel that I'm being counterformed here. This hasn't been all that comfortable for me. But we have been shaped through practices. And those practices should be pretty diverse. I love... We're in basketball country, kind of. My favorite sports movie is Hoosiers. When Gene Hackman's character comes to the gym for the first day and they're all shooting, he says, no more shooting. We're going to pass. We're going to dribble. We'll play defense. You know, and they can't stand it. But there's so much more to basketball than just learning to shoot. There's so much more to the faith than just, you know, certain kinds of practices than just worship and hearing a sermon.
Amen.
What are the various practices that form us? All right, I left this about 12 minutes. Boom. Questions that you have, thoughts that you have. Yes?
So what is the idea about getting children involved? Because it's about practicing, so.
Yes.
What is your idea?
Yeah. Wow. So that's, let's just keep going. Another session. So I will say, I'm a big proponent of the conversation that's been going on under the umbrella of sticky faith. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, stats are not good in terms of our young people graduating from high school and staying connected to their faith through young adulthood. In fact, if your church would probably be consistent with the average, walk into your youth group tomorrow morning, look around and say 6 or 7 out of every 10 kids in your youth group will drop out of active participation in their faith by the time they're 19. I don't know what it is about your sophomore year of college, but it's not a good year. And only half of those who drop out will come back. So just look in your youth group tomorrow and say 3 or 4 out of every 10 students in here we will lose if we hold true. Part of the sticky faith conversation has been not just ask why do we lose them, but the other question has been why do we keep any? What's true about the 3 or 4 that will stay? And one of the things that they're finding is, and this is really discouraging, by the way, for those of us who pastor large churches, small churches tend to do better with helping their young people get into adulthood than big churches do. And here's why your question made me think of it. And a lot of that's because we've segregated our generations. So this is a really cool room, and I don't go to church here, so I'll pick on them. But this is a really cool room, and I'm guessing it's some kind of youth or children's room, right? It's a cool worship space. If this is normal, we'll have really cool children worship space in here, and they'll get through adolescence, and they'll have their own space. They'll come to worship, but we won't do anything that sort of includes them or makes them feel like this was their service. It was just their hour and a half they needed to endure. And then we're like shocked that they graduate from high school, and we don't let them back in this room because it's kind of creepy now for them to hang out and you know, date the high school girls. So we kick them out. But we wonder why they never have they've never associated the sanctuary, they've never associated the church with theirs. Where in small churches, man, as soon as you can play D, A, 7, and G on a guitar, we make you a worship leader. And as soon as you know, we feel like you can walk without dropping the offering plate, we make you an usher. And, so I remember growing up in small churches, we were actively participants. The worship service was ours too. And so, one of the things we've thought about, we're a large church, but if you come to College Church on a Sunday morning, you'll probably see the worship team is not just made up of the pretty people who can sing, but it's usually an older folk or two, maybe a teenager or junior higher that's part of the worship team. The ushers will include children and young people. I'm trying to get better at preaching in ways that includes the children and young people. That's a really important question. I mean, we've got to think about how families worship together. There's something really good. Please don't misunderstand me. There's been something good about churches figuring out how to meet people and instruct people in the ages and stages that they are in. But there is a huge difference between a multi-generational church and an intergenerational church. Mm-hmm. And the research right now is saying kids who make it into adulthood usually come from intergenerational churches, not multi-generational churches. Is that kind of your question?
Yeah. Then, what do you do if people are against children singing songs on stage? Because sometimes they say the parents are just promoting the kids singing.
Well, yes.
Not showing them off is what I
mean. Yeah. Part of the instruction we need to do with young people is how to lead worship. I get that sense too. So this is not just to say, invite the 17-year-old girl who thinks, and this is going to date me, but who thinks she's Amy Grant to sing in worship. And she's going to, by the way, she's going to lead in worship like she's Amy Grant. She's going to close her eyes and she's going to dress like she's hip and cool. And she's going to perform for us like she thinks she's a Christian artist. And there's nothing evil about that. But she doesn't really let us in worship. I mean, we really haven't taught kids how to not be celebrities. We haven't taught them how to be conductors of worship. We have taught them well how to be performers of certain things, but we haven't taught them well. I say to my worship leader all the time, I love the creative stuff we do, but when we do stuff that's so creative that 2/3 of the congregation drops out of singing, we're not leading worship anymore. We're performing.
Yeah.
And so... So every time it gets quiet out there, know that I feel like we have failed in how we planned worship today. Right? I think we need to think through what is the formative value of specials and that kind of stuff in the first place? Is this just one more attempt for us to create a complex of? I think this is about our productions and that kind of stuff. Is this just a way for us to foster the sort of minor celebrity status that some people in our congregation have? Or is this truly an opportunity to form us as something, to offer both to God and to the congregation a gift? And how do we help them understand that we're offering to God? God is the audience. They are not. Your friends are not. God is the audience. And so how are we offering to God this gift that shapes and forms and may bless those who also get to participate in the giving of that gift? But that's a different... we're not having those conversations. We're having a conversation that says, did you like it? You liked it, right?
Yeah.
The kid's cute. That was a really loaded question, too, by the way. All right. I got 5 more minutes. I'm not that anxious to see the people at Southwest Airlines. Yes?
Okay, so since nobody wants to go on that topic, I'll go off still on children.
Yeah.
Like, what practices could you have within your home that would be a liturgy to form?
Yeah. So, again, that's a long conversation, and I think there are things, if you're not familiar with, there's a ministry called Godly Play that has done a really good job of shaping biblical stories in ways that invite children into them, and we've used them a lot in the integration of worship. But at home, so there's all sorts of research being done right now on how much healthier kids are, not just physically, but mostly emotionally and in all sorts of ways, when you're eating together on a regular basis as a family. But what is the... So we're deeply shaped by Eucharist, but what does it mean for the Eucharistic table to be extended into our homes? To be aware that Christ is present at our table. And so we have conversations. I'm often shocked at how few... So we made a... When I was in Pasadena, my poor youth minister stepped into a mess, and we didn't mean to. But we had a parent and kid meeting going on, and we were talking about some of the sticky face stuff. And he said, you know, how many of you right now, if I handed you the mic, how many of you kids, you could tell me your parents' journey of faith? You could tell me about how they came to Christ. You could tell me about their struggles in faith. You could tell me. My kids raise their hands because we preach it all the time. But my kids raise their hand because they hear us talk in front of people. But there were only like three or four other kids in this huge room of people that raised their hands. And it was one of those moments where we knew there would be a few people who didn't raise their hands. We didn't realize it would be almost everybody. When you get in the minivan on Sunday morning, I usually turn around the kids and say, hey, what did you guys talk about in church today? Because I'm checking up on the children's pastor. But how did, you know, what did you guys talk about in church today? They never ask the question back. What did you guys learn? But you should talk about that. You should talk. You know, the sticky face study says it does not do our kids a favor. We as parents think we should model unassailable faith as though we've never really struggled in faith to our kids. That is a huge mistake. Because when they struggle and they have doubts, they don't talk to you because they're not sure you've ever had them. They go talk to the dumbest people they can talk to, their friends. And that's not helpful at any level. You know, so how do we do that? I am a big proponent. First of all, I love people who recognize giving, tithing is an important discipline for us as a family. Because I'm really selfish, and if I don't tithe, I'll start to believe that this is mine. And I need spiritual disciplines that remind me, everything I have is on loan. None of this is mine. I am a tenant with God. I am not an owner. I am shocked at how many families don't talk to their children about how they give as a family. Like, we have this idea that giving is super private. I mean, tell that to Ananias and Sapphira, first of all. But we think it's really private. But we won't even talk to our kids. And then we think somehow they'll magically become tithers. You know, so we as a family talk often about the things that we're not going to do because we feel missionally that our resources should be invested missionally. And kids, here's why we're not doing this, or here's what we're investing in, and we're inviting you to help us participate in that. So, I mean, there's all sorts of liturgies as a family that I think are important that say we are a weird family. We don't have curls, and we don't wear yarmulkes, and we don't, but we're still weird. And there's lots of weirdness to us, and here are the ways in which that weirdness happens. But... hey, so fun. Shalom. Blessings on you. Bless.